Maybe I get closer to it with this young. I can, I move. So it might. We'll see. So this evening, I would, because Stephen in the morning might talk sometime a little more abstractly, a little more philosophically, and in the evening, what I like to talk is really in more practical terms about meditation, but also about daily life. So what I like to talk about tonight is meditation and what I call creative awareness. Because personally, I don't think the main aim of meditation is just to sit there and become the most incredible accomplished meditator, nor is it just to wait for some special state. Because I think often that's what we do. You sit in meditation, and generally actually you don't sit as much as wait for something special to happen. So you're kind of there waiting, and then suddenly something special happens and you get excited and then it goes. But I'll talk more about this at another time. But to me, actually, I would say the main reason in terms of really practicality in daily life, of course, when we see there will be different special states, but I'll talk about it another day. But what we, to me, seems to do when we develop meditation is creative awareness. So it is not like a blank awareness, but it's an awareness which, in a way, is creative. And as such, I think when we meditate, we develop the power of this creative awareness. So I would say that the meditation in itself, the walking, the sitting, the awareness, eating, working, whatever it is a training. Is a training in developing together concentration and inquiry, samatha and vipassana. And that when we cultivate them together, then it develops into this kind of creative awareness that then we can take into our daily life and manifest, apply, and it is there. So how does it work? I think first you have the concentration, and this is generally most people have experienced this, that if you try to concentrate in meditation, generally it helps to develop calm, to develop stillness and spaciousness. To me, the most important one, in a way, is spaciousness. But why, as we just focus on the breath, why is it that when we focus on the breath, we generally feel more spacious? And the reason for that is not that we stay all the time on the breath, but it is because we come back to the breath. This is a very essential element. Because every time we come back to the breath, we actually are not feeding our mental, emotional, and physical pattern. Because generally that's what we do. We think a certain way, we feel a certain way, we have certain sensation, and we just kind of, in a way, either exaggerate or proliferate with them. When, with the focus, the concentration, we go a bit, but we come back. We go a bit, and we come back, which means two things happens together. One is that we don't feed the habit, and at the same time, by returning to the breath, we dissolve its power. Which then means that the habits and patterns can come back to useful function. Because to think, to feel, to sense, this is a natural function of the organism. And I think in a way that's what the meditation does. It makes us recover the functionality of our being instead of being caught in the habitual, into the patterning. And then you have the functioning of the heart, of the mind, of the body. And then its potentials can really come out. They can really, because of that spaciousness, then the potential can, as a space, to come out to express itself. So in a way, that is for the concentration. Then you have the inquiry. This is also the vipassana, the looking deeply, the experiential investigation is also very essential. So it's not just about concentrating, but it's kind of using the faculty that this being has of being vivid, of being clear, of inquiring, of being creative. This is a very important energetic element in the meditation. The fact that we don't just focus on the breath, we notice its connective nature. We don't just focus on the sound, we notice the changing nature, the conditioned nature. So we really, in a way, go as close as we can to the experience itself. So that it's not a knowledge we have, but it's an experience we have in our whole body and mind. I think that's what Stephen was trying to express. And that, actually, seeing the changing nature, seeing the conditioned nature, really actually, in a way, give us choices. Because how does it feel? Let's say, I don't know, some of you today might have felt sleepy. And if you feel, I was sleepy today, I am going to be sleepy the whole week, it would have been better staying at home, then I could have done something more interesting like tennis or whatever it is you do, then in a way you are making it unchanging, this sleepiness. But if you realize this is the first day, I'm a little tired, sleepiness has arisen, and sleepiness can pass away, then you have a very different relationship with sleepiness. You're not fixing it. Because I think this is often we fix things. When we don't see the changing nature, the conditioned nature, we fix ourselves, others, a situation. And so I would say to see the changing, to see the conditionality actually gives us choices. We can start to have more multiple choices. We can be creative with, okay, what's going on? Do I need to rest, or do I just need to be with this, or whatever it is? Instead of fixing, it then stops us from actually having any movement in the situation. And so I would say together, the inquiry and the concentration, the calmness, the vividness, the spaciousness, the creativity, then develop, uncover this creative awareness that we can start to experience in meditation, but I think so much more we can experience it in everyday life. And generally there are two images associated with concentration and inquiry. One is concentration, it is said, is like when you have a glass of water with mud in it. And if you shake it, then you can see through the liquid. But if you let it sit, then the mud goes to the bottom and you can see clearly through the liquid. And generally inquiry is compared to when we enter in a dark room and we see something in a corner and we think, snake, and we get very frightened. But if we put the light on, we see it's just a coil of rope, and then we're not frightened anymore. So inquiry is like putting a light on something we misperceive and now can perceive appropriately. And in a way, I would say my first experience of this creative awareness was when I was in Korea. This is quite early in my day of being a nun, and we generally meditated 6 months of the year, 10 hours a day. And this was my second retreat. And we were sitting for our 10 hours a day, as they do there, so this is the ordinary schedule. And I was sitting there. And after about 3 weeks, suddenly I saw something I had never seen before. I was 22. Up to that moment, because since I was 11, I wanted to save the world, I had this impression, this idea of myself as being very compassionate. That, you know, if somebody needed it, I would give them my shirt. That, you know, yes, I was really thinking of others. And as I sat in meditation, I suddenly totally realized that I was totally self-centered. I had not seen it before. But it was very clear. I realized that everything I felt, everything I sensed, everything I thought was me, me, me. And at that time, I would have said the percentage was 95%. Me and 5% others. And then we were four women sitting together in that room. And then I looked at everybody else. And I realized that they too were fairly, like myself, self-centered. And it made me see that when our self-centeredness coincided, we were quite fine. But when it did not, then we used to have argument and difficulty. And to see this, I did not feel, this is terrible. I am a nun, I am a Buddhist, I am self-centered, this is bad, ooh, you're bad, bad, bad. I just thought, isn't it funny? Isn't it, here I am, just thinking of myself, here they are, just thinking of themselves, and it was kind of weird. I just thought it was really funny. And to me this is, in a way, one of the things about the creative awareness is it's not like doom laden. It's just very light. It makes you see, this is the case. This is what is going on. Now, what are you going to do about it? And when I was with these women for 2 weeks once in the 3 months, we had this amazing moment. For 2 weeks, everybody did everything because of the other. It was amazing. It was really amazing, peaceful, loving time. I've never experienced this in that way, I would say. It was quite special. But like everything, it was impermanent. So it turned into more self-centeredness and thing. And in a way to see that when we see something like that, the aim then is not to go to 0%. I am going to be not self-centered anymore in my life. But I would say it's to bring down the percentage to 50%. Because, you know, if I don't take care of myself, who is going to do it? Only I can do it. But I need to do it in consideration of others, so that there is more that balance between self and others. And so I would say that this is the two characteristics of creative awareness: acceptance and transformation. And so this acceptance, this is what I think is this lightness. Because when we see something, it is in a light way. It is not in a judging way. It is, that's who it is. And that's why I think acceptance is part of the meditation process. To see clearly what is going on. But really fully. And in that seeing, there is a lightness about it. Because there is spaciousness around it. We don't fix ourselves. I am like this, I will be like this forever after. It's not, that's who it is. Condition has given rise to this, what can I do about this? And then there is this, I would say, transformation can only arise in a way outside, after the acceptance. We need to accept ourselves first, accept others first, before there can be transformation. And the transformation, I think we have to be careful, can be in two ways. It can be a transformation which happens with the acceptance, or it can be a transformation when we do something about the situation, about the condition. I think it's not just one or the other. It just depends what is going on. And I would say within that acceptance, there is acceptance of our positive and also of our negative quality. I think this is very essential. That the positive quality will make us, if you really see what is good within you, what is positive, what is skillful, what is capable, then actually you appreciate yourself so much more. And you can also see more clearly other people, good quality, capacity, ability. And with that, you become more confident. And so I would say the meditation actually, although in Buddhism we talk about no self, but no self is no separate fixed self. Actually, I would say meditation is actually to help us to develop a very confident sense of a functional self. And we'll talk more about this maybe at another time or in the question if you want. And so, because, in a way, the more we accept our good quality, the more we're conscious of them, the more we can trust in them, the more we can develop them. I think this is very important to see that this is a fluid, moving process. It's not just, I have this quality just like this. It is creative within itself. And I know for myself, when I was at school, I was very bad at composition. Whenever I wrote anything in French, I used to get really bad marks. And I would have never thought I would become a writer. Never, ever. But then I was translating my teacher's talk in Korea, and Stephen said, oh, why don't we do a book? And I said, why not? Then later on, when I came to England, somebody said, oh, you're interested in ecology, and me too, and Buddhism, we're doing a book. Why don't you help to do this? I said, why not? But I could do this because I did not fix myself as, I am a bad writer. I cannot write. I thought, I can try, and we'll see what happens. But in the doing of it, which is a very creative process, then I learn to do it. Then I can do it more. Then it can, in a way, develop within itself. In terms of accepting the negative aspect, I think a lot of the time, we actually are quite blind. I mean, we know in some way our negative aspect, but not really. I feel we're more kind of like slaves to them, blind to them. We're kind of like caught in them. We find ourselves caught again and again and again. And I think the meditation helps us to see, yeah, what is my negative tendency? What are my weaknesses? What are my limitations? I remember early on in my nun's career, when I was in Korea, and because I was a Western nun and I knew the language and I used to help with the guest. And one day we got this guest who arrived, foreign guest, and I was explaining to them about Buddhism. Because they asked me, you know, what is Buddhism? And so I said, well, in Buddhism, you have the Four Noble Truths. You will hear about them tomorrow. But my problem in these early days is that I could not remember them. I never could remember the four. You know, it's always one missing, and you know. So here I was, you know, birth, noble truth, suffering. And I was, what's the second one? And then suddenly, I see a Korean monk going away with a bucket of persimmon. You know persimmons, khaki. It's a fruit you pick from a tree. And this was my bucket of persimmon. And I got up and I went, you can't take my bucket and this is my persimmon. And, you know, I took it and said, okay, you can. And so I took my bucket of persimmon and then I went back and said, ah yes, the second truth, craving. Then the cessation of craving, then the Noble Eightfold Path. And I felt very happy. I had remembered the second one. And then there was another nun there, a foreign nun, and the guest had gone and said, but did you notice? I said, noticed? Noticed what? I said, well, you were a bit funny with the persimmon. I said, and it's only then I realized how weird it would have seemed, you know, the way I kind of went on about the Four Noble Truths and not realizing I was caught totally in the second one and in the first one. But often we're blind in that way. We kind of go through the motion and we don't see even that we've gone through the motion. And I think at that level, the meditation, the awareness, the acceptance can make us see, yeah, I have a tendency to behave in that way when there is certain condition, which can lead to suffering for myself and others. So we might not necessarily change them, but I think the fact that we're aware of it, I think will actually diminish its power over us. I think this is what is quite essential. And in a way, within that awareness, that acceptance, to see how do things arise. Because we're not always jealous, angry, whatever it is that bother us, that limit us. We are not always like this. But according to certain condition, we feel this, we behave in certain way, and according to other condition we want. So in a way to really, through the awareness, to see how does it feel? How does it manifest? What is the result of this? I think this is very important and very much what causality is about. And that's why in a way the emphasis on the awareness, first of the breath, to settle. But tomorrow we're going to do awareness of the body. And I think awareness of the body is essential. Because a lot of the time, we're caught in the story we tell ourselves when we get caught in our negative tendency. We have stories why it is a good idea for me to feel like this, even if it's so painful. I have the right to be angry. This is often we feel that. And I know for myself, I am more of the irritable tendency, so I know quite a lot about anger and these various manifestations. And my first really seeing of it was some years back. I had a very, let's say, tense discussion with another Buddhist. Because Buddhists, of course, generally try not to be angry. But then they get extremely resentful. That's what happens with the Buddhist often. So, you know, you have like conversation, you don't raise the voice, but the vibes is fairly heavy. So I had one of those, and I said, but yes, I will do it. And she would say, no, in the past you did not do it, you won't do it in the future. And I said, no. So we could not agree. Then I had to cut it short, because I had to work. In those days I used to cook for conferences. So I go to work and, you know, I'm cutting my carrots. And suddenly I see what I'm doing. I see that I'm cutting the carrot in a funny way. And so I go inside the body. And I look, what is going on? And the body was shaking. And I saw that nobody was doing this to me. I was doing this to myself. It's me who was creating the trembling, the suffering. And as soon as I saw this, I dropped it. And then I looked in the mind, but what was I telling myself? I was telling myself, I am right, she is wrong. I am right, she is wrong. And then I realized, she must be doing exactly the same thing in the other side. I am right, she is wrong. And I realize we are both right and wrong. And again, I let it go. And I just then cut my carrot with awareness and calmness. But it showed me that in a way to, this is the thing, if we're really aware, if we really accept what is going on in the moment, if we penetrate it, then we see the suffering we don't really need to create. Of course, I could still disagree with her, and I could still change my behavior, and then she would see it. But I did not have, in a way, to exaggerate and to proliferate with it, but just be with the situation as it was. So I would say that actually the meditation is the cultivation of the power of creative awareness. So at the beginning, of course, there is little power. So you feel that this is not really working. When I sit in meditation, yeah, I can be calm and this is okay. But when I go outside and then somebody says something, then you get, you know, really upset or whatever it is. And so I think this is what we're doing, really. That whenever you sit in meditation, whenever you walk, whenever you do meditation, in whatever way, you are adding to the power of creative awareness. To finally the point where the creative awareness can become active and responsive. And then really it can make a difference. And I would say in a way there are four stages to this developing the power of creative awareness. The first stage is what I would call when we kind of start in meditation and you become more aware. And what happens is that you become aware at the end of the cycle. You are reactive, something happens, you react to it, you're totally caught in it, you're totally this is the right thing to do, this is the only thing to do, da 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 da, then it's finished, then you, oh, I did this. Yes, it's a little dodgy. You know, you start to see it's not such a good idea, because you can start to see the ramification, the pain, the suffering. And so you see this a few times at the end. And then you move to the middle, which is you're right in the middle of it. You're caught, you're angry, or you're upset, or you're jealous, or you whatever it is. And suddenly you see yourself, you're not so caught in it. You see yourself doing it. And then you feel very frustrated, because you see it, but you cannot stop yourself. And I think at that moment you really wonder, does this really work? Because it seems to be worse. Now I see it. When before you were caught in it, so in a way you were blind. Now you see it and you think, wow, wait a minute. Whew. But you cannot stop it, because the power is not strong enough. And then you get to the beginning, when the pattern is going to start to happen. And then because the power of the awareness is stronger, you start to see that in a way you have a choice. And this happens when you start to see what is the trigger. This is very important to see. What is the trigger? I remember when after I was first married with Stephen, whenever he went away by himself, I used to get very upset. And then he would fall and I would be really bad on the floor. And then I saw this happening. I said, wait a minute, what is going on? When he's here, I'm okay. When he's not here, I'm not okay. Then I saw it was only two sentences. Two sentences were the trigger. The two sentences would arise and then I would go into this maelstrom of kind of stuff, really negative stuff. And so what I did was when I saw those two thoughts, then I would do something else. I would go for a walk, I would go and read, I would do something else. And within twice, they disappeared. And now I can't even remember the thought at all. I don't even remember them. They're gone. But you see, when it works on you in this negative way, you think they're more powerful than you. But I think the meditation makes you realize it is not so. They're just thoughts that arise. What can we do with it? But I think the most beautiful is when we actually see before the pattern arrives. This is a very interesting moment. Well, if you have developed the power of awareness, you can actually see the condition that it gives rise to the pattern, and you can see yourself just before you do it. And then at that moment, you see you have a choice. And this happened to me once, where I used to have a habit that if somebody hurt me, I would not speak to them. So when I was young, it was weeks. Then as I meditated, it kind of diminished a little, you know, days. And so somebody said something, and then the next morning, I could see myself, just that feeling of closing off. And then I thought, no, I am going to do something else. And in that moment, there was an incredible fear. The fear of doing something I had never done before. And this is why we stay stuck in our negative patterns. Because we prefer the pain of the known than the non-pain of the unknown. But there was a power, so I thought, okay, this time I will do it. So I turned to the person, I smiled, I talked. And I felt this amazing ease. And I thought, but why did not I do it before? Because I did not have the power. But after that, I could not do it again. But because of compassion, because until that moment, I had not seen how painful it was for other people. And now I could see how painful it was, not only for myself, but for others, to be cut off, to be ignored. And so now I cannot do it. I have not ever done it since. So in a way, to see, this is in a way what the creative awareness is about, what the meditation is about. That will be creative awareness that we're developing during the retreat, is in a way in order that we can take it into our daily life. To me, this is very vital. That is, you don't just meditate in here, but actually you're meditating, you're training yourself, you're in a way training your muscles of creative awareness, so that when you go home, you can bring this creative awareness to work. How do you work? This you can look into. How do we work? Are we very present to the work? Are we very present to the body, the mind, the heart that work? Are we present to the condition? Or are we working and actually ahead of ourselves? Often I think when we work, we're already finished and we're already somewhere else. So actually we cannot be present fully to what we do. Or we're working, but actually we do it very automatically. And then we're very distracted. We're thinking of something else. But in a way, can we work? And can we use, can we be efficient? And at the same time, can we be very present to what we do? Or in relationship, bringing creative awareness to relationship. This is also, I think, an interesting one. Because often, when we are in relationship, often we are what I call conditional love. I will love you, but you must change this. This is often the thing. You know, if you change this, then really I love you. No problem. But I think love is actually to say yes to the person. Actually to really accept the person totally. And then, if there is difficulty, you can start from the acceptance. Instead of starting from the conditional. I mean, we to see, when I am with someone, what do you expect from them that I don't necessarily expect from myself? Often I think, you know, what if how we feel when somebody said, I love you, but we feel, ooh, like something is, ooh, missing. And how does it feel when somebody, yes, I love you, I accept you in your whole being as you are? Then we can talk, we can discuss things. One thing with Stephen, we do a lot of travel, and so we go, we are a lot in airports. And I noticed that I used to get a little stressed in airport. And I noticed something, that when things were stressful, I would go faster, and Stephen would go slower. And so, of course, first, I thought he would do it on purpose. Then I realized it was his way of survival. If things are difficult, he goes more slowly. If things are difficult, I go faster. And so now, when something is difficult, I just laugh. Because I see us going into the mode, but because we're aware of it, we're not caught by it. And I think, okay, he goes a little faster, I go a little slower, and we kind of, you know, manage. But it makes a big difference. So in a way to look, what is going on? What is happening? What are the conditions? Also with listening. I think listening, and we'll do this in 2 days' time, and I think it's very important, listening. How do we listen? How can we listen creatively? When we listen, what do we do generally? I would say we do 3 things. You listen, but actually you wait for the person to stop, so you're going to say something so much more interesting. So, you're waiting for them to stop, you're trying to remember that so much more interesting things you're thinking about, and third, you're listening. So, you're not really listening. Or you listen, and bodily you listen. But you are thinking of your shopping list. And what is interesting in those moments is when the person says, what do you think? And you have not the faintest idea what they said. You have no idea. You have ears. So, I mean, you heard. But you did not listen. Or you listen and you overreact. Not really. You kind of, in a way, too caught in what the person says. And to me, creative listening, this is really something we can practice in daily life, to really just listen. Just listen, not preparing, not waiting, not being distracted, not over, just being totally there for the person. And what is interesting if you do this, is that when they stop, and when it's your turn to say something, you generally will say something much more wise, much more creative, and often you will surprise yourself. Oh, I did not know I could say this. Because there is a space for it to come out, to be creative, instead of being caught in some abstraction which has to do with actually something before, instead of totally responding to the immediate situation. Another thing we can look at, especially here, is what I would call creative awareness in nature. I mean, we have a little nature here. I mean, especially when it's hazy, it's quite, you don't see all the houses and things. But it is quite nature, very nature, and it's beautiful. And so you might go for a walk, and I would really encourage you to walk around here in nature, to gaze at the sea. We discovered the sea this morning in the far. But when we walk, what do we do? You go for a walk because it's good to walk and it's good to have fresh air and everything. You go for a walk. But actually, you think of the office, or you think of the family, or you think of the past, or you think of the future. So actually, you're not really present to walking itself. And what is interesting is when you see it, that you caught somewhere else, and you come back to the body, to the walking, and you come back around you. And what is interesting is that everything then seems to glimmer. You know, the blue is bluer, and the yellow is yellower. And you think, wow, this meditation, phew, it's magic, you know. But it's not magic. It's actually removing the veil of our distraction. And we just see things in a way as they appear in that moment. We have the space to see them in that way. We don't have all these veils in front. So in one way, it's not magic at all. The only magic is, in a way, the dissolution of the abstraction into something else and the coming back to the experience in this moment. And I would like to finish with a quote. A little long, but I think it kind of shows several different things. And this is a quote from a Zen master of the 12th century in China, Master Dawei, which is, I could say, my favorite Zen master, though he's fairly unknown. But there is a good book which has been recently republished. And that's what he says. This master is very much used to correspond a lot with lay people. And his practice is very simple, and I will introduce it in day before the last day. I will introduce what he taught. And so he used to correspond with people, and they used to ask him questions about their practice and how things were. And he seen that this person wrote to him, and his son was very ill, and he was very upset. And that's what the master says. I take it your fifth son is not recovering from his illness. It is precisely when afflicted that you should carefully investigate and inquire where the affliction arises from. If you cannot get to the bottom of its origination, then where does the one who is afflicted right now come from? If you want to think, then think. If you want to cry, then cry. Why I like this quote is because it in a way presents us with different way to practice, different way to be aware, different way to use the meditation. But that in a way this creative awareness is not just one way of looking at things. But actually we can have different modality of responding to things. So what do we say? The first one, it is precisely when afflicted that you should carefully investigate and inquire. where does the affliction arise from? So he's saying basically you feel in pain, you are suffering, but look deeply. Where does this suffering come from in your experience in this moment? But he says, if you cannot do that, if you cannot get to the bottom of its source, then where does the one who is in pain right now come from? Where do you come from? So in a way, kind of, instead of getting caught in the story, you see, where are you now? What is going on now in this very moment? But then he says, if you cannot do that, if you want to think about the situation, then think about it. But also, if you're very sad about the situation, and if you feel like crying, just cry. So in order to see, maybe this different response we can have. And I think it will depend very much on the condition. Sometimes something is happening, and we can really look inside it. And in the looking of it, in a way, its kind of painful nature will go. Or we can look at the person who is suffering, and how that person is suffering. And in a way, what are the contributions to the suffering? Or we can just reflect on it. He could have reflected that, in a way, the son was very ill, but the son was alive. The son was not dead yet. And so to enjoy the son while he was alive. Or he might have, you know, these waves of sadness. And then just to cry. But to cry in such a way that you're not caught by the feeling, so that it doesn't become a disturbing emotion, but that you really know the feeling. And then when it passed, then there can be joy, there can be something else. So, that is what I wanted to talk about tonight. And we make it so that there is a little time. Now there is about 10 minutes, 15 minutes for questions or comments, if there are any. And then after there will be the walking meditation. I would say yes, but I am also aware that sometimes people say, you know, do the concentration first and then do the inquiry. Personally, it seems to me more practical to do the two together if we can. But this also depends on a little the condition. If you are agitated and you feel, you know, little agitated in the body, in the mind, then I would say, just concentrate on the breath. Just in a way calm the body formation, as the Buddha said. But if you feel quite fine and you can relatively easily focus, then you can focus and then look inside the breath, its changing nature, its conditioned nature, its connective nature. Or, you see, so that you can apprehend the two at the same time. And then sometimes, I would say one can become in a way nearly too quiet. And the Buddha says that, like in the Anguttara Nikaya, the Buddha says, if you put too much emphasis on concentration, then it can lead to indolence. If you put too much emphasis on effort, it can lead to restlessness. If you put too much emphasis on equanimity, then you will not actually remove difficulty. And so what the Buddha is saying, we need to have the middle way in meditation. So generally I would say most of the time we can do concentration and inquiry together. Sometimes concentration might be more appropriate, and sometimes vipassana, to kind of energizing kind of body and mind, is very useful. And that's why I say, you are your own teacher. It's not for me to say, now concentrate, now vipassana. Only you know what is going on in your condition. But at the same time, you have to be careful not to think, well, now concentration of vipassana. You know, I think, you know, just generally start with just focusing. I think this is always useful. And then try to be present. So you focus, but also being present to the changing nature. So with the breath, to notice, it comes cooler, comes out warmer. Or with the sound, comes and it goes. With the sensation, very much they come and they go. And if the sensation stays, what is it, if you have a sensation which stays a little long, go inside the sensation. And again, it is fluid, it is changing. So generally I would personally try, if one can, to put the two together. But again, according to condition. Because I think we need both in daily life. We really need both for, so that we can use it.
When you have this insight about your self-centeredness when you were a nun, neither of the techniques that you described seem to be immediately leading to that kind of content or thinking. So,
you see, I did not think it. You see, I think that's what Stephen was trying to... You see, in Korea, you will see this the day before the last day. In Korea, the thing I did, I was just sit there, because we did not do awareness practice there. But I think it's very good, awareness practice. That's what we teach both together now. In Korea, I used to sit and just ask, what is this? That's what I did. So I did not think of being aware of my self-centeredness whatsoever. Not at all. I was not thinking. I was just doing what is this, and of course being distracted and sleepy like one is usually. And that's, to me, that's what showed me, in a way, the way it seemed that the creative awareness worked. So you do the job. For me, the meditation, the job is to cultivate concentration and inquiry. So just in Korean Zen, what is this? What is this? And as I was doing that, I developed creative awareness. So that one day, suddenly, I saw totally clearly, I am just thinking about myself. Everything I think is about me. It really was like, I saw it. Totally clearly. I have never seen it again as clearly as this, but now I can, I mean, I know it. This was like a sudden thing. I did not expect it. But I just saw it. And then I looked everybody and I just saw them too. That's why I think that's what Stephen was talking about. It's experiential. You see something. It's not that it did not exist before, but you see something you've never seen before in that way. And having had that experience, now I can recognize it. I can see, ooh, this is really just you here. You know, and then I can try to diminish that. And I can try to be more open to others. But yeah, the Korean meditation is not about thinking, reflecting at all. Not at all. Does that answer your question? So in terms of the practice, that's what personally, I think no matter what you practice, if you are a Buddhist practitioner, if you cultivate together concentration and inquiry, in whatever way you do it, let it be a Tibetan way, a Zen way, a Vipassana way, I don't think it really matters. What I think matters is that you do these two things together, because generally this will, it seems to me, come out, this creative awareness. So in a way, it's a product of a training. And that's why, in general, I will give you multiple choice. Stephen does not always agree with this. But personally, I rather give you a choice, and then it's for you to try it out. You know? To focusing on the sound, does it feel better? Focusing on the breath, doing the question. I don't see this as opposed, as different things. I feel there are different tools of awareness. And so that's why when I suggest something, I generally say, you know, you can observe the breath at the nostril or at the belly, or you can observe the whole of the breath. Tomorrow, I will introduce sensations, and I will suggest three different ways. As just a contact, as an intense sensation, and also in the guided meditation, I will introduce body sweeping. And I think this is three very good methods. And there is many other, but I think three might be enough. And then it's for you to try out and to in a way become your own teacher. And I think very much a meditation retreat is an experiment, is training in tools of awareness that then you can try out in your daily life.
Yes? You've always referred to Stephen's talk, and I wish I could...
What he's talking about is, you know, the Buddha said that he saw dependent origination not through mere reasoning. You know, and the point, of course, you see something through the consciousness of it, but you experience it in your whole body and mind. Because personally, I think often we are caught in our ideas about things. We can have very good ideas about things. But I think what the Buddha is really talking about is to know experientially. And I think the meditation, that's why it's a training. Again and again, I know it's a bit repetitive, and you sit there and you think, you know, well, often people come and say, but isn't there something a little more juicy, a little more, you know, special? And I say, well, you can have, you know, certain states, but they generally don't last long. And generally it's fairly undrawn. But because, in a way, it's like cultivating the soil. You know, you put things in it, and then salty kind of comes out of it. And I think that's what, you know, Stephen was talking about, and what I was trying to talk about, that we just, through this, cultivating concentration, cultivating inquiry, something happens experientially. And I would say, one of the first thing that happens experientially, and you could check it out, is what I call the effect. Maybe you never heard of the effect. And this, you see, because often we sit in meditation and we really expect something. You know, maybe not the first day, but maybe by the third day, you know, something should happen. Or at least we expect that we're not going to have any thought. This, I think, is one of the great hope, is not to have any thought, or very little thought. And so you sit there and, of course, you have lots of thought. Why do we have thoughts? Because we have a brain. Because we have neurons, they're firing. It's good that you have thought, because it means that you have a brain which fires properly. No problem with that. But the problem is when they kind of, when we identify, we caught, we agitated. So, what is the effect? Is you sit, and generally, I would say, most people, at the end of the meditation, will feel different. You will feel, even if you had a bad meditation, there will be this, you feel different. And I saw it when I was in Korea, and I was doing a retreat by myself. All my co-nun had gone somewhere else. So I said, great, I'll sit by myself. Nobody is going to bother me. But it was really difficult, because, you know, just by myself. And then, you know, lots of thoughts, and I thought, you know, this meditation is not working. Maybe I should do something more useful. So, okay, I'm going to read a Buddhist book, a sutra, that. At least I'll do something useful. So I got up from the cushion, I went to take a Buddhist book, and I tried to read it. And I could not read it, because my mind had relaxed. And to me, this is one of the main effects of meditation. It's this, what I would call, I'll talk more about it possibly tomorrow, de-grasping. But actually, experientially, the whole body-mind complex learn de-grasp. So at the end of it, even if it was not such a good meditation, you feel a little differently. You feel like your whole body, body and mind, heart, as something has happened. And to me this is very important. And to me this is why when you leave the retreat, generally you will feel different. And often people say to me that the effect lasts about 2-3 weeks, 3 months depending, but that they feel different. The way they look at people, the way they look at themselves. Because all this tightness, all this fixing, all this has in a way relaxed. There's been this releasing. So I think again this releasing is not an idea, it's an experience that we can all experience.
Why couldn't you read the book then?
Because of that, my mind. Actually, although it was thinking, and I thought it was too busy and it should not be so because I had an idea of how it should be, actually my mind had really relaxed. And so it did not want to focus on a specific thing. I think it had entered what I would call a kind of meditative state. Right? You don't want to kind of, in a way, kind of get entangled with something kind of more precise, more kind of... So I went back to meditation. So I think this is enough for now. Thank you. And then we have 30 minutes of walking meditation. And then we'll meet again at 8:30 for the final sitting.